You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is Wednesday, May 25th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Ari Berman of The Nation. He will join us to discuss Elizabeth Warren's, I guess, attempts to be head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the Republican attacks on her, and the stunning, stunning Democratic victory in New York 26. Also on the program today, a little update on the Middle East. We'll hear from George Dekai via video. He won't be... Although we could also hear him.
You are a douchebag.
And he's got a great ad out today online. Not today, but in regards to more of the Republican culture war, we will get into that. And speaking of the Republican culture war, here is a Republican war on disaster relief. And I have to say, at least House Majority Leader Eric Cantor has the integrity to be blatant in what the Republican perspective is on the value of government and the value of society. And we're going to talk about this later, but we got Paul Ryan going around crying that people are misinterpreting my Medicare proposal. Well, in fact, no, people aren't misinterpreting it. They just don't like it. And at least Eric Cantor, I will give him points. They're horrible points. They're wretched points. They're disgusting points. But I will give him points for at least being explicit with the Republican mindset. The number two House Republican said yesterday that if Congress doles out additional money to assist in the aftermath of natural disasters across the country, a massive tornado in Joplin, Missouri. There's more, I guess, in Oklahoma. I mean, it's people are just devastated there. 110, is it up to 111 people died in a town of 50,000 people in Joplin, Missouri. Did I say Mississippi? Joplin, Missouri. Just the images are horrible. The devastation is amazing. And what is Eric Cantor's response? We will not provide disaster assistance unless we cut somewhere else. They're going to use... I mean, it's just another hostage-taking situation, isn't it? We will not provide for any assistance that could help feed, clothe, house people who have been struck with this tragedy unless we can cut some other stuff for the poor people. Now, they don't do this when it comes to tax cuts. Any dollar you cut in terms of taxes contributes to the debt or deficit as much as any dollar you spend to help someone whose life has been destroyed. by a natural disaster. But for Republicans, the idea of us living in a society and organizing as a society so that we can help people in situations like this, so that we can spread the risk, essentially. We're not all going to be subject to tornadoes. We're not all going to be subject to natural disasters. But we don't know who will be. And so we organize as a society. We form government to actually provide this function. And here you have the Republicans saying, we're not going to provide disaster relief to these people unless we can cut some other type of relief to people. Food stamps, maybe. Maybe health care. Who knows? It doesn't matter. Of course, we all remember what happened with Trent Lott. Remember Trent Lott? He had the same attitude until his house was ruined in the wake of Katrina. Then it was like, we've got to get help to these people very quickly. And I'm willing to bet that Representative Billy Long, freshman Republican, who replaced Roy Blunt down in Missouri, I'm willing to bet this guy from Joplin, he won't have the same attitude. I guess we'll find out. We got to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Ari Berman on the Republican attacks, not just on Elizabeth Warren, but the whole idea of a Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And we will also be discussing New York 26, where Hochul, the Democrat, defeats Corwin, the Republican, in a district that is 6 points more likely, 6 percentage points more likely to vote for a Republican in just about any election. It's the first time I think a Democrat has held this seat in over 40 years. And my theory is this actually has very little to do with party and more to do with an issue. And that issue is, of course, people like their Medicare. And why wouldn't they? We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Majority Report. My name is Sam Cedar. On the phone, it is a pleasure to welcome back to this program from The Nation magazine, author of Herding Donkeys, Ari Berman. Ari, welcome to the program.
Hey, Sam. Thanks for having me again.
Always a pleasure. Always a pleasure to have you here. Let's go into just briefly New York 26 before we get to you were covering the really just ridiculous attacks on Elizabeth Warren. But we'll get to that in a moment. Let's talk about New York 26. Give me your sense of just how important this election is. It's a special election. You've got a replacement for Chris Lee, who I think he won with 75% of the vote last time. And apparently he had to skedaddle after those pictures of him shirtless on Craigslist showed up. It's not something you always want to do. I always remind people, please keep your shirt on, regardless whether you're selling a computer or your attractiveness.
Yeah, you think that would be kind of political 101, right? Don't put shirtless pictures of yourself on Craigslist if you're a member of Congress. But the dumbing down of the U.S. Congress never seeks to amaze me. But in answer,
do you think that was a function of just how? Do you think that was a function of just how safe he felt in that seat there? Like, if these pictures
or
show
how brazen or how brazen he felt now that he was elected a member of Congress. But I think this freshman class of Congress is not the brightest bunch, as we've already seen, and so the fact that he did something this stupid, I don't find to be that surprising. But I do think that the victory is a big deal, because it goes to show you what the narrative might be in 2012, which is that if this narrative can stick, if Democrats can make this narrative stick, that Republicans want to dismantle Medicare, dismantle the social safety net, they can run on that message in every single district in the country. They don't have to have one message for the blue states, one message for the red states. They can have one message for everywhere, which is almost like a reconstitution of the 50-state strategy. So I see that as being a very big deal, because Republicans now are going to be playing defense, essentially, for the next year and a half, unless the dynamic significantly changes. Even though Democrats still have the problem, and Obama still has the problem, of a bad economy and a lot of social unrest, but nonetheless, it's Republicans now who are facing all the questions about what they will do.
And this, of course, is because virtually to a person, I think there was four in the entire Republican caucus, voted for this Medicare proposal in voting for Paul Ryan's budget. What were they thinking?
I've been wondering that a lot myself. Number one, I think this is the clearest indication yet of where the Republican Party stands and what they really want to do. I mean, they've been out for 30 years to destroy the social safety net. They've succeeded in some very big ways, and now they're going after these sacred programs under the guise of deficit reduction, but the public is saying, we don't want you to go there. This is not how we want to get to a balanced budget. I think what they are thinking is that they had the momentum, right? That the public was on their side, that they had a mandate to do this, but they clearly overreached and misinterpreted the mandate of the 2010 election.
You know, I'm of two minds of this, because in one sense, I'm thinking like, wow, this is probably the best example of the of Barack Obama's 11-dimensional chess. I mean, he seemed to be Paul Ryan's biggest booster for months. I mean, right? I mean, he when they had that big powwow with the Republicans and the president that was televised, he really sort of put Ryan on a pedestal. He keeps talking about Ryan being a smart guy and this and that. Do you think that they were just basically sucking? Well, on one hand, I think they were just sucking Ryan in. On the other hand, I'm not so clear that the Democrats are actually going to pick up this mantle.
No, I agree.
You know,
I mean, I agree. I don't know if this is example of the Zen chess master, or else it's just they got lucky and the base pushed back. The Democratic base pushed back on what Democrats were planning to do, which is cut a deal with Ryan. For a long time, I think both of us were saying that our biggest fear was that Obama and Paul Ryan would end up in a locked room together and walk out with some sort of grand bargain. That would be a lot worse than the Simpson-Bowles deal actually was. But I think Democrats honestly were moving in that direction. Everything in Obama's post-2010 strategy moved in that triangulatory direction. But what happened is Democratic activists sent a very clear message that they were not going to tolerate this. And the Obama people looked at the polling and they said, it's bad politics to cut Medicare. It's bad politics to cut Social Security. These remain very popular programs. And then once the House Republican budget passed and they saw that how far they were going, and they saw that Ryan just kept digging himself deeper and deeper and deeper, and they realized this could be a big issue in 2012, then they decided, at least rhetorically, to hold firm. But we don't know what's going to happen next. There's still negotiations over the debt ceiling. They could still buckle on this issue. It's far from clear that this is a settled matter.
In fact, Steny Hoyer came out, I guess it was yesterday, in sort of stunningly bad timing, walked out of the Biden negotiations, said, yeah, Medicare's on the table. Why wouldn't it be? I mean, that just seems, it's just, you know, to me, this is one of those moments where it is so naked. If Democrats come out of that room with any cuts on Medicare, it is so naked as to what their genuine agenda is, at least in terms of what sort of drives the leadership of the party. There really is no more excuses left, right? I mean,
no, and you know what? And cutting Medicare honestly isn't about balancing the budget. It's about giving health insurance companies the biggest profits they've ever had and the biggest windfall they've ever had, which is the ability to run this program. I mean, Ryan wants to expand the subsidies that private insurance companies get under Medicare Advantage as part of his program. That's the long-term plan here, is to put everyone in private insurance. And so Democrats are crazy if they go along with it, because it's not even going to lead you to a balanced budget. But the Democrats and the Democratic leaders in Washington are feeling pressure to do something quote-unquote serious, right, on spending, that they feel like they need to nod to independent voters that, yes, we're willing to cut two. And so that's the danger in this discussion.
But that's the part that I don't believe anymore. You see, that, I mean, that's the part that that just is not clear to me. I mean, when you see something this stunning, and I don't think it had anything to do with the fact that she was a Democrat and Corwin was a Republican. I think it had to do with Medicare and everything that spins out of that. When you see this as a much more powerful force, I mean, never mind independents, Republicans voted for her.
Yeah.
And so when you see this as a much more powerful electoral bludgeon, it really seems to me to mitigate and negate the idea that we've got to project a serious face on when it comes to Medicare for the sake of electoral benefit. I mean, because I think it's almost at the very least. I mean, when you combine the polling and you combine the sort of the wake and the spin that's coming out of this, it seems to me that that is the far more potent electoral device.
Well, it is. I'm not disputing that. I think the way to do it, if you obviously the Democrats are going to talk for the foreseeable future about balancing the budget. Now, you'd think that they could find enough spending cuts without touching Social Security and Medicare in combination with raising taxes on the rich, and it. Basically, you can get there to a balanced budget by doing that. There isn't a need to talk about these Medicare cuts. I do think that the Beltway conventional wisdom is starting to suck Democrats in, but maybe that same conventional wisdom, as you said, is changing. Maybe now they realize, okay, touching Medicare is a bad idea. They might talk about it rhetorically, but I would be surprised, given where they're headed with 2012 messaging, if they would actually do substantively to allow Republicans to break out of the defensive position that they're in.
Yeah, it would be a stunning reversal. And, you know, my sense, and just we'll move on to the Elizabeth Warren thing, but my sense is that what the Democratic activist base did here was not so much about, was very early on being very aggressive about making it clear what Paul Ryan's budget was. I mean, I'm sure you remember that first week that his budget proposal came out, many even left-leaning commentators were talking about how responsible this was and how bold, and at least it shows some integrity, when in fact it's clear now that, I mean, we got Paul Ryan whining on, I think it was Morning Joe, they're saying, they mischaracterized my Medicare. It's Metascare. No, it's not. It's being very explicit as to what this is.
Well, the left-leaning economic policy groups, the Economic Policy Alliance, the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities, the Center for American Progress, they did a terrific job, in my view, of really breaking down what this budget would do. That it wasn't a plan to balance the budget.
Right.
It was a plan to destroy the social safety net under the guise of deficit reduction. And it was full of tons of gimmickry that wouldn't get us anywhere close to a balanced budget. There was no revenue coming in, the spending cuts wouldn't be nearly as high, and the amount of savings that you would get from privatizing Medicare would not at all offset the amount of money you would lose in terms of how expensive it would be to run these programs through a voucher system. So it was a terrible deal for consumers and for people. it wasn't about a balanced budget, and it was very, very right wing in its ideology. And I think once all that stuff started to come out, people had time to process it. The narrative on Ryan started to change, and he's been on the defensive ever since. And now you see people like Newt Gingrich, which is kind of amazing, right, starting to throw him under the bus, which is just a pure reflection of where the politics are. I mean, Gingrich has no principles. So the fact that he's doing it is just a clear indication of where the politics are in this.
Do you think that we're going to see people, I mean, how are the Republicans going to walk away from this? I mean, because they clearly want to. You've got already Bonaire already whining that Harry Reid is going to bring this up for a vote in the Senate.
Like that little French pronunciation you got there.
Well, I believe he's French-Canadian heritage, right? Am I not right? But he's crying that Harry Reid is actually going to make Republicans in the Senate vote on this thing. He's got to be feeling the heat at this point, because this was a complete miscalculation on his part.
They can't walk away from it. They can't walk away from it. They already voted for it. I mean, Democrats had this problem with cap and trade and some other bills that they passed that the public didn't like that much, which is, if you've already voted for it in the House, it's going to be very, very hard. Now, Harry Reid wants to hold a vote on this in the Senate, which is going to be very interesting, because you have all these senators that are running for re-election, or they are challenging Democrats who are up for re-election in 2012. A number of these Democrats are in tough seats.
There's something like 33 Senate seats that are up, and 21 are 22 are Democratic.
So that's gonna force every person to take a position. Every Republican challenger or incumbent to take a position on the Ryan plan. And if they come out for it, that's going to be a major electoral liability. And if they come out against it, it's going to further the narrative of the Republicans in disarray, which is usually the Democrat narrative that is now transferred over to the Republican Party, at least temporarily.
So in the end, this is advantage Democrats for theirs, for them to lose.
It really should be. It really should be.
All right. Well, let's move on. You wrote a piece about the House Republicans escalating their attacks on Elizabeth Warren. They have already said in the Senate, right? In the Senate, they've already said, we're not going to confirm anybody for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Well, that's instead of we can't get rid of it. So we're just going to make sure there's no staffing of it.
Yeah, I actually have a much longer piece coming on The Nation next week about this that will provide all the exhaustive detail that I'm sure are clamoring to know about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. But just to step back and provide a little bit of context, this was one of these things that an idea from Elizabeth Warren to have a bureau that would police the financial services industry, which did a lot to contribute to the economic crisis, set up new rules, make all the fine print that no one understands, those mortgage statements, those credit card statements, easy to understand, finally, provide some accountability not only to the biggest banks, but to all those unregulated entities, the payday industry, the student loan companies, et cetera, et cetera. This was a very big deal in 2010. A lot of Republicans hated the idea. The financial industry hated the idea. A lot of conservative Democrats hated the idea. Nonetheless, it became law, and Elizabeth Warren was appointed under a lot of pressure from the left, appointed to lead this agency. And Republicans
to lead the creation of the agency.
The creation of the agency,
right.
To set
it
up
actually,
before its launch date.
Right. It actually hasn't
launched until
yet.
July 21st.
Right. Okay.
And no one knows whether Warren will actually be around to lead it. This is a source of lots of speculation inside Washington. And basically, ever since Dodd-Frank became law, Republicans have been trying to dismantle and undermine and chip away at the authority of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau before it goes live. And the hearing yesterday on the Hill was just an escalation of those attacks, where the subcommittee chairman of the House Oversight Committee, Patrick McHenry, basically accused Warren of lying before Congress with very little evidence to actually marshal to provide any basis for that claim. And it was honestly, I mean, I've covered a lot of hearings on Capitol Hill. I've never seen a committee chairman be so rude to a witness.
Now, wait a second. Now, he accused her of lying. What did he accuse her of lying about? Was it like multiple things, it seemed like?
No, there was really one claim, which is not a new claim, but something he resurrected, which is that there's been these long discussions between state attorney generals and the largest banks who are accused of massive and have admitted to massive foreclosure fraud. So there's this been attempt to get this multi-billion dollar settlement
right.
that the state AGs are working on with the banks. Elizabeth Warren provided and admitted to providing some advice to the state attorney generals, different options for a settlement at the behest of the Treasury Department. She told the Congress that she did this in March. But nonetheless, Patrick McHenry and other Republicans on the Oversight Committee and on the Financial Services Committee believe that Warren misled the Congress and has essentially been masterminding this settlement in an attempt to screw over the banks. But so basically,
in and of itself, is like what? Okay, what is the? I don't even sure what the problem of that is.
Well, the problem ostensibly would be that the Justice Department's in control of this and not the CFPB. The CFPB hasn't launched yet, so it wouldn't have the ability to mastermind a settlement. But it didn't mastermind a settlement. It provided advice, and that's what Warren said. We provided advice. We've already admitted to providing advice. There's nothing to hide here.
And we should also add, there's no settlement.
There's no settlement. No, there's no settlement. And just to make this even more complicated, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, which is the bank's existing regulator, announced their own settlement with the banks that is viewed as far more lenient than what the state attorney generals are pushing and is viewed as an attempt to actually undermine the state attorney general. So that's a whole other story. But basically, what's going on here is this is another argument meant to try to undermine Warren and undermine the Bureau before it launches. And at one point, it was so funny that the hearing devolved into a linguistic discussion of the meaning of the word advise. And the Merriam-Webster definition was flashed on the big screen. And I felt like we were in the Clinton impeachment hearings all over again.
So, at one point, the guy was also accusing her of lying about the scheduling of the whole thing, too, right?
So they changed the scheduling a bunch of different times because there was votes, and I don't know what else was going on. But at the end of this very testy hearing, there were votes in the House, and the hearing wasn't officially over. Other people hadn't been able to ask questions. So McHenry said, "Can you stay longer?" And Warren said, "You told me I could stay for an hour. I have other meetings to go to." I mean, if you look at her schedule, just by the way, it's packed. She has meetings. Her schedule is public, and she has meetings like every half an hour. So she's at a breakneck pace on a tight ship trying to launch this 1,000-person agency by July. And so obviously she had other stuff to do than just to submit to McHenry's grilling. And McHenry said, "No, we never made any agreement with you about the time." And she said, "Yes, your staff did make an agreement about the time." And he said, "There was no such agreement was made." And basically, they started arguing about
who their
staff is.
So this is just really, this is really just about making her, trying to make her as toxic as possible so
yeah.
that she doesn't get a recess appointment, right? Because Obama's
Absolutely.
Going to have to, make a recess appointment here of somebody because the Senate has already said we're not going to confirm anybody.
No, and the Senate has already said they're not going to confirm anyone without these changes to the Bureau. The changes that they want to make would essentially cripple the Bureau's ability to act in a number of different ways. They're not going to re-legislate this issue. It was already passed in 2010, and it's about to launch. So, yeah, the Obama administration has no option but to recess someone. And this is really, in terms of the larger question of what the administration stands for, this is really a very, very important fight, because the difference between Elizabeth Warren running that agency and some toothless bureaucrat running that agency is huge. It's a new agency. It could have potentially a lot of power, but there's a lot of forces, a lot of industry forces, a lot of people inside the administration who don't want it to act, who want to preserve the status quo on behalf of the banks. And so they're facing a very difficult test right out of the gate. And if they don't have strong leadership at that bureau, it could very well wither in the face of all these different attacks.
And lastly, a former foe of hers, I guess, representing sort of regional banks and smaller banks, has come out in support of her candidacy. Is that right?
Yeah, the head of the Oklahoma Bankers Association. And I think that's an indication of she's done very, very, very aggressive outreach with all the different community banks saying she's not trying to undermine the financial system. She's trying to put in some stability and protection for consumers that would have, in many ways, prevented the kind of economic crisis that we had. And I think that's something that a lot of community banks, even though they don't want any additional red tape, that message is something that a lot of the community banks are sympathetic to. And so they feel comfortable with Warren. She knows what she's talking about. She's been open to their concerns. In person, she's a lot less easy to demonize than this boogeyman that the Republicans have created.
Is there a divergence in agendas from the community banks and, let's say, other national or regional banks?
There are different. I mean, one of the biggest differences is just that the community banks, banks with assets of $10 billion or less, are exempt from the CFPB's rules, from its enforcement. It's quite complicated, but basically the CFPB will write rules for the whole consumer financial industry, but those rules will be enforced for smaller banks by the existing regulators, whether it's the Fed or the FDIC or the SEC. So the small banks are not as concerned about this as the big banks are, because the big banks are under the CFPB's purview in terms of rules and enforcement, as is the 80,000 people in the shadow banking industry, the payday companies, the mortgage brokers, et cetera, a lot of whom have never been under federal regulation before. So there's a lot of different interests competing here in terms of trying to weaken the Bureau.
Interesting. Well, Ari Berman, thank you so much. Folks, you can check out Ari's piece in The Nation. And he dropped by The Nation all the time. He's always posting stuff there. He's got a big story coming out in, I guess, next week on the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Ari, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, Sam. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
All right, folks. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back. We got more news for you. How is rape like a flat tire? Well, a Kansas Republican will tell you in just a moment. We'll be right back after this. Till the end of time. So you got to let me know. Should I stay or should I go? It's always tease, tease, tease. You're happy when I'm on my knees. One day it's fine and next it's black. We are back. So if you want me off your back. So in Tennessee, just visiting the states for a moment to watch, see what the Republicans are doing up on their ongoing culture war against anyone who is not like them. Tennessee State Senate, they have passed a law. It's not a law yet because it has to pass the Tennessee Assembly. They have passed a bill at this point, if I remember my Saturday morning cartoons correctly, that says that teachers cannot mention the word gay to students under in grades below ninth grade.
Any mention of homosexuality below ninth grade.
Yeah, you can't say Heather has two mommies, even if Heather has two mommies. My daughter attends school, has had friends who have two mothers, and with two fathers. Apparently, you would not be able to say that to the kids. You would not be able, obviously, you would not even be able to use the words homosexual. Because, of course, you know what happens when you say homosexual in front of a seventh grader. You turn them gay. And then you know what happens then. If there's too many of those gay people, then God punishes all of us with some type of natural disaster. And so this is really just to protect the kids. George Takei has a very funny ad that I want to play.
Hi, I'm George Takei. A bill recently approved by a Tennessee Senate committee would prohibit teachers in that state from discussing homosexuality in the classroom. The so-called Don't Say Gay law is premised on the misguided belief that by not talking about gay people, they can simply make us disappear. I'm here to tell Tennessee and all LGBT youth and teachers who would be affected by this law that I am here for you. In fact, I'm lending my name to the cause. Anytime you need to say the word gay, you can simply say, Takei. For example, you could safely proclaim you are a supporter of Takei marriage. If you're in a more festive mood, you can march in a Takei pride parade. Even homophobic slurs don't seem as hurtful if someone says, "That is so Takei." And around the holidays, you can sing, "Don we now our Takei apparel." Speaking of apparel, I've created a t-shirt. It's okay to be Takei. I hope you wear it proudly. We also have buttons, mouse pads, and mugs, all in time for Takei Pride Month. And all proceeds go to charity. Thank you. And as they say on the Flintstones, have a Takei old time.
It's okay to be Takei.
There you go.
It's okay to be Takei. Takei, Takei, Takei.
Just stunning. And meanwhile, we have teachers who are not allowed, or those freaks in Tennessee have their way, will not be allowed to say homosexual or gay or discuss it in any fashion. And at the same time, you've got food and advertising industries complaining that a proposal for guidelines in marketing to children, asking them to voluntarily limit the way they market sugary cereals and other shit for food snacks to kids, would be, in their words, a curtailment of their First Amendment rights. Just stunning. Same with if you ask disclosure for people who are donating money to candidates, corporations who are donating money to candidates and also getting government contracts. That is an imposition on their First Amendment rights. But when it comes to Tennessee, you can't say the word gay to students under ninth grade. 15-year-olds, I guess. And when it comes to doctors in Florida, you can't ask patients, "Hey, do you have any guns around the house that are not locked up? You should lock them up." They can't say that. That's not a problem with the First Amendment. But to in some way ask food makers to voluntarily not market their shit directly to kids, then you are you're infringing on their rights to essentially sell shit to children. But it's branded with a funny peak, with a funny toucan. Meanwhile, in Kansas, there was a the Republican majority passed a law to ban insurance companies from offering abortion coverage in their general health plans, except when a woman's life is at risk. This is in the last 15 minutes of the last Kansas legislature. One pro-choice Republican, State Representative Barbara Boyler, feared that Republicans were cutting off, quote, a way for women to cover the cost of terminating pregnancies, particularly when they're unintended. See, this is all about morality, right? It's all about morality. Those slutty sluts getting themselves pregnant, presumably without the use of a male penis, because men can't be sluts. Only slutty slut women can be. During the House debate, she, quote, questioned whether women who would buy abortion-only policies long before they have a crisis or unwanted pregnancies or are rape victims. So, in other words, you're not allowed to have abortion coverage as part of your health care plan. You have to go out and buy a special rider. The implication being like, well, you'll know it because you're a slutty slut. And if you're a slutty slut, you know, if you have sex, if you're planning on having sex, you should buy this. Otherwise, you're left to your own devices. Because condoms never fail, because women are never raped, That never happens. So she expressed this problem of like, hey, people don't really know if they're going to need an abortion. But State Rep. Pete DeGraff, Republican, was ready with a impressive retort. DeGraff said women should plan ahead for situations such as rape because, after all, quote, I have a spare tire on my car. I also have life insurance, he added. I have a lot of things that I have planned ahead for. Ladies, walk to the mirror right now. How are you dressed? Do you look like you're looking to be raped? If you are, you should go out and get that abortion insurance in Kansas. Only you know if you're a slutty slut slut. So if you live in Kansas, sit yourself down and just ask yourself, am I a slut? Do I think in the future I'm going to be a slut? In which case I should buy abortion insurance. Stunning. And turning back briefly to New York 26, just a couple of things I wanted to dispense with. You've got Paul Ryan out there crying, like I said, when we were talking to Ari Berman, that this whole thing in New York 26 was all part of Metascare. He said that this is a Medicare story to be told here, and it's that the president and the party have decided to shamelessly distort and demagogue Medicare, calling it Metascare. Having the ability to scare seniors is powerful, but no word from Ryan after he says, I don't think it will work, in talking about 2012. With 15 or 18 months to go, the facts will get out. What are the facts here? The facts are is that he wants to destroy Medicare, keep the name, provide vouchers for senior citizens to go out into the private insurance market and buy health insurance. Do you know who will sell health insurance to 65-year-olds? No one. Not at the prices in which a 40-year-old could get it, or a 50-year-old, or a 30-year-old, or a 20-year-old. That's insane. 65-year-olds are going to need their health insurance, are going to spend more on health measures than anybody who is younger. So the idea that you'll be able to get health insurance cheaper than it would be from Medicare is ridiculous. And so the money that Ryan will give these people will not cover health insurance. That's the bottom line. Republicans should be honest about this. They should say, we don't believe in providing full health care coverage for seniors. They're willing to say that for the rest of the people, right? They're willing to say, we won't allow for people to buy into Medicare. We won't allow for people to get health care coverage for the rest of the country. That's why we want to rescind the Affordable Care Act. They should be honest about their Medicare proposal. There's no facts that Paul Ryan can tell people that will change their mind about this. They simply miscalculated. They live in a deluded world where they think that people don't believe they deserve health care. And then he goes on to say that the Republican nominee Jane Corwin was the victim of a third-party candidate in the race, Democrat-turned-Tea Party candidate Jack Davis, who won 8% of the vote. So there was about a 6% split between Hochul and Corwin. If you're going to assume that all of Jack, every single voter, would not stay home if Jack Davis wasn't in the race, they would simply vote for the Republican, 8%, and then subtract the 1% of the Green candidate, right? Because there was a Green candidate who got 1% of the vote. Presumably, I go Hochul. Then you would have a plus one victory for the Republican. But that's a bunch of bunk. As Nate Silver writes, based on the way that district votes in presidential elections, there is a 6 percentage points more Republican than the country as a whole, this district. Ms. Corwin would have won 56% of the vote, and Ms. Hochul 44%, a 12-point victory, if it was just about Jack Davis getting the vote, if it was just about a Republican versus a Democrat. A 2-point win instead, therefore, referring to if every single vote for Davis went for Corwin, would have spoken to a relatively poor political environment for Republicans, as it were. In other words, no way. This is about Medicare. And the only importance in that is, as we said with Ari Berman, if the Democrats don't pick up this mantle, it's not because of politics. It's because they have an agenda that is not terribly distinct from the Republicans. And one other factor I think that's going to play big in 2012, if the Democrats want it, I've talked in the past about the stunning success of GM, posting profits now for, I think, 3 quarters in a row. All the jobs that were saved, they're hiring more people. And now Chrysler is going to be paying back their $7.6 billion federal loan 6 years earlier than projected. And why does that make a difference? Because listen to some of these Republicans. This is a DNC video. This is an excerpt from it. These Republicans back when this was being proposed. Listen to the apocalyptic fervor that these guys have. Back when the idea that these loans would go to Chrysler, the idea that we would buy part of GM, which much of it has been sold off now. Listen to this.
The crisis of the auto industry. What should be done there?
Should the federal government bail out the auto industry? Mitt Romney, former Massachusetts governor and former Republican candidate for president, says absolutely not.
There's no question but that if you just write a check, that you're going to see these companies go out of business ultimately.
You said, quote, if General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler get the bailout that their chief executives asked for yesterday, you can kiss the American automotive industry goodbye.
If you write a check, they're going to go out of business.
And why can't they get the loan if that's what they're seeking from the private sector?
Mr. Speaker, the most radical president in American history.
I think that's clearly true. Look at what they did with General Motors and Chrysler.
And then it's a slippery slope. Where does it end? You know, who's next? Yeah. That is my friend who owns a small business in Minnesota. If he's having a hard time, does he get a loan? So it's a slippery slope.
I don't know why for them Chapter 11, or at least some sort of pre-structured Chapter 11, wouldn't be a viable alternative rather than the taxpayers bailing them out.
I love hearing Palenti say, what about my the small business that needs – well, actually, I think you can get small business loans from the government. But aside from that
– I like the guy who says, look what happened with Chrysler. Okay, let's look what happened.
Exactly. Exactly. That's Newt Gingrich. So these Republicans, once again, their ideology and I don't know why we don't hear more about this, frankly, from the White House. I don't know why we don't. I don't know why. And I guess Obama's probably saving this. Why not wait for 6 to 8 months and go and visit some Chrysler plant that is booming, some GM plant? I think you're going to see a lot of that. All right, folks, that is our program for today. Give you a Mideast update in the post-show. Tomorrow on the program, we'll have Robert Cruikshank. Wrote a very interesting piece at Daily Kos on the coalition building and the two different factions of the Democratic Party. In the post-show, I'll give you that update on the Middle East. Folks, if you can become a member, and some of you have, we got another professional leftist yesterday. Maybe I should, you know, if we had a way of knowing whether or not people want to say their name or not, I try and maintain people's privacy, but we got a professional leftist yesterday. We had actually someone fairly well known become a professional leftist last week, but I'm not going to pimp that person out. If you have the opportunity to become a member, please do. We desperately need your support to make this program better and to continue this program long term. And I've mentioned that we're in danger of falling behind projections, which is a bad thing, because if you can't project, then look what happened to Chrysler. Look what happened to Chrysler. If you have the opportunity, please buy a craft through our Amazon link. Also, go to justcoffee.coop, buy some coffee, tea, chocolate, 10% coupon code, majority in the coupon code box. Do yourself a favor, fair trade. And you can always donate your account at donateyouraccount.com. On Twitter, donate it to Majority Report. All right, folks, see you on the flip side.